As most of our listeners are well aware, this November, Oregon voters will be confronted with two ballot measures. Measure 105 would dismantle Oregon's 30-year-old sanctuary state status and open up immigrants of color, particularly, to new forms of state surveillance and targeting. Measure 106 has been termed a backdoor ban on abortion because it would make abortion effectively inaccessible for low-income women. As we confront the resurgence of white supremacy and fascism nationally and in Oregon, it seems like an important time to excavate the intersecting histories of Oregon's fight in the late 1980s and early 1990s against both white supremacist violence and a violent homophobic backlash. In the latter case, the Oregon Citizens Alliance loomed large. The Oregon Citizens Alliance, or OCA, ran three major ballot campaigns. Measure 8 succeeded in rolling back Neil Goldschmidt's executive order banning the state from engaging in discrimination based on sexual orientation. The ballot measure was enacted in 1988, the same year that Mulugeta Sarah, a 28-year-old Ethiopian student attending PSU, was beaten to death by skinheads with ties to an organization known as the White Aryan Resistance, or WAR. Following criminal convictions of Sarah's attackers in 1990, Sarah's family, represented by the Southern Poverty Law Center, would win a $12.5 million settlement against Tom Metzger, the main organizer behind White Aryan Resistance. The lawsuit effectively ended WAR's reign of terror in Oregon, though quite clearly not white supremacist organizing more broadly. Also in 1990, my guest, Catherine Stauffer, was assaulted at an OCA event, and in 1992, Stauffer won a civil suit against the OCA in the weeks before Oregonians voted down yet another OCA-initiated measure, Measure 9, which would have amended the state constitution to mandate new statewide discriminatory regulations to discourage homosexuality, which the measure equated with pedophilia, sadism, and masochism. The OCA would also go on to mount another statewide initiative, Measure 10, which would have mandated parental permission for abortion. Both Measure 9 and Measure 10 failed. Listeners who are interested in learning more about this history should definitely check out the website of the Rural Organizing Project, which traces its own roots to this period in Oregon history and the fight against the Christian right and the OCA, a fight in which Pekun was also a key ally. ROP's website also provides context on organizing by ROP, Pekun, and CAUSA to defeat a 1995 anti-immigrant measure. The online Oregon Encyclopedia includes an article on the OCA written by Randy Blasek, who references a wave of anti-gay hate crimes in 1990, including the murders of Hattie Mae Cohen, a 29-year-old lesbian, and Brian H. Mock, a 45-year-old gay man, who were both killed in a firebombing. I spoke with Catherine Stauffer on Friday, September 21st, about her work infiltrating the OCA and the protracted legal battle she fought to effectively bankrupt and neutralize the OCA. Stauffer is also featured in a new documentary film on the fight against Measure 9. So can you tell us a little bit about how you got involved in this fight against the OCA?
I moved to Oregon in 1990, and when I got here, I was very interested in researching what was going on with the Christian right. We had a huge problem with an anti-abortion movement. Operation Rescue, Advocates for Life were really, really organized in the state of Oregon. And I started looking into what they were doing. I had been the editor of my college newspaper. I was only 22 years old. And I was also active with ACT UP. So I started going to events that the anti-abortion movement were organizing, and I came across the discussion about, they had an idea that they were going to sponsor an anti-gay ballot measure, and I was really instantly alarmed, and I kind of went from being someone who wanted to research what was going on to someone who was fairly determined to stop what was going on. I infiltrated them for a year. I managed to collect all kinds of information about them, from who was involved to who was donating funds to what their political strategy was. And I started turning it over to their political enemies. Came from a certain social vantage point, being a young woman. I recognized that older men would brag to me, and I could write down information and then follow up on the phone and really get a lot of information, and that's what I did.
And you were working as a photographer at this point?
Yes, I was also working as a photojournalist for a couple of newspapers in town, including Just Out.
Okay, which has gone under since, but Just Out was a really important purveyor of information that impacted the LGBTQI community in Portland. Yeah.
So I did this for a year, and at some point I figured that they probably knew what I was doing, and I stopped. But they kept me on their membership list, and they sent me an invitation to their premiere screening of the anti-gay video they were going to use in their campaign, taking place in the Foursquare Church here in Portland. So they sent me the invitation to that event, and I just sort of figured that at that point they probably knew what I had been doing, but sort of carefully weighed out my options and decided that I would attend this event. They had me on their membership list, clearly their mistake. And I showed up at this event, and then I was accosted by Scott Lively, who's now internationally famous for drumming up the anti-gay sentiment in Uganda and all over the world at this point, and is facing crimes against humanity charges. But he removed me from this church. He picked me up, he threw me into a wall, he dragged me across the church and then out the door and into the gutter. After I had been assaulted by Scott Lively, I decided to sue them with a specific intention of slowing them down. You know, when you sue someone, you can request 2,000 discovery materials. You can cause them a lot of stress, and you can really deplete them of energy, and that was my intention. The year between when they managed to collect the signatures and when this went to the voters was an increasingly stressful time for gay people in Oregon. Even the police chief said that there was an imminent sense of danger in Oregon. The time I went to trial against the OCA, the city was really, really under pressure.
So you infiltrated the group in 1990, you were assaulted in 1991, and then the case went to trial in 1992, just weeks before the vote on this ballot measure 9.
Yeah, it was an incredibly stressful time in Oregon. Organizers were told to stay in groups. The police department actually had different activists assigned police officers. It was a time of real terror for gay people in Oregon when I went to trial. And it was a very stressful trial. But I did win that trial, and I won a judgment from that trial. And I'm not sure what the impact it had on that election, but I walked away from the judgment that was given to me. I won a $31,000 judgment, but I really had only had the intention of slowing the OCA down. It was never my intention to collect the money, and I didn't believe that I could collect the money. So I went away, and I had a couple of easy years. But the OCA were symbols of terror in Oregon, and attempted to come back a couple more times. And at some point when I was in my late 20s, I realized that I could probably set myself up as a creditor to the OCA and start draining their bank accounts. I could probably sue them to get the money that they owed me. And then it might really politically slow them down, especially if I said that I was a gay rights activist. I thought that it might send them to war with themselves. And it did. That worked. They started returning their campaign donations because they were afraid that they were going to go to a homosexual. And I hauled them into court over and over again. And eventually, we found them kiting money between their corporate entities. And I filed a lawsuit against them for that. And Lon Mabon, eventually, I thought if we waited him out, he would probably lose his legal resources, which he did. And he took it up. He took up the cause himself and became his own attorney. And he decided that his legal strategy would be to claim that the judges in Oregon weren't real judges and that he wouldn't have to follow legal orders because the judges had taken the wrong oath of office. So he stopped showing up for court. And that was pretty much principally his political destruction. He was arrested in the courtroom. He was shown on television in a prison outfit, and that was pretty much it for him. I worked really strategically at this time. I made an unconventional business relationship with one of my attorneys, who was a very powerful gay man in Oregon, and I started signing over the legal fees that were awarded to me every time I won something in court directly to that attorney so that he had the ability to collect the money himself. But every single time I went to court with Lon Mabon, I would win more and more money, and he became more and more buried in this situation. eventually I declared victory and I got out of the public eye because I had achieved what I needed to achieve. And I think people assumed that I had been paid, but I was never paid, which was just left a huge threat for Lon Mabon, because I made it very, very clear that we would be very happy to come back if he lifted his head to do anything politically in Oregon ever again. And he hasn't. So it was effective. Scott Lively had to pay his portion when he graduated from law school, but the OCA's portion was never paid. I had to individually sue Lon Mabon and Bonnie Mabon for decisions that they made on behalf of the OCA to make them individually responsible then for the money that the OCA owed me. So that's how they became entangled in this.
You know, again, there's a critical connection between the way in which Tom Metzger with the White Aryan Resistance was essentially driven out of business by a lawsuit by the Southern Poverty Law Center. And that basically took that group down. Tom Metzger was bankrupted. So there's a lot of connections here between the story of the OCA and the story of the White Aryan Resistance. I mean, these histories intersect in some critical ways, and the coalitions that fought these groups intersected in some really critical ways.
I think the one thing I want to say that's really important for this time period, there probably aren't a lot of activists that have infiltrated organizations and hate groups before. And I think it might be easier than people think. And it is an effective type of activism. I was always concerned that I would be forced into conversations that I wouldn't be able to have. Like, I literally would not be able to have a conversation about hating homosexuals with the OCA. But sort of the way these organizations work in these is that these conversations actually don't occur. Showing up as a witness, just taking down the most basic information, who's there, what the plan is, what the strategy is, are they potentially breaking any laws? Just the most basic information is incredibly critical to get. So there's a documentary coming out, I believe, this fall about this time period. It's about, in particular, I think it's focused on how the music scene organized around fighting ballot measure 9. It has Nirvana in it and a whole bunch of other bands that were really popular at the time. And it's made by some MTV folk. Jeff and Jennifer Crawford are making the documentary, and I think it'll be coming out relatively soon.
And so you were interviewed for that film. Do you know what the title is?
Ballot Measure 9.
We've gotten so much news recently about FBI surveillance and infiltration of environmental groups, Black Lives Matter, and other groups on the left. The left is far more often targeted for infiltration.
It's not going to be just anyone's work to infiltrate a hate group. It really isn't. And I'm not going to say it's not without its personal costs, because it is. But it's an important job. So I really encourage people. I mean, there's probably not a lot of you out there, but I encourage people to do this. It works. The important thing to understand about the OCA is the degree to which they failed. They caused a pandemonium in Oregon. It took millions of dollars, so many volunteers. Churches came out and organized against their ballot measures. People had to individually come out to their communities that they knew someone that was gay or had someone gay in their family. So that's the important thing to take away from the OCA, is how radically they failed. Because it completely changed Oregon. The experience of being gay really changed in Oregon and began to change nationally. It was the first anti-gay ballot measure here in Oregon, but others followed across the country, and those failed as well.
Yeah, and maybe that's an important lesson. These things don't go down on their own. We can't ever take for granted that they're going to go down on their own, and it just takes a massive battle and organizing to keep these forces down and to affirm the value of the community members that are under siege and stand in solidarity and resistance.
The one thing you want to understand about the OCA is that their intentions were clearly genocidal. Like, they triggered the Holocaust survivors for a reason. Scott Lively went on to organize in Uganda for the death penalty for homosexuals.
Right, and that just, I think, again, foregrounds the link between the fight against the OCA and the fight against the White Aryan Resistance. It seems as though there's a lot of common elements between the strategy that you pursued and strategies that Antifa pursues in going after white supremacists and Nazis today. So my guest today has been Catherine Stauffer, who was instrumental in the takedown of the Oregon Citizens Alliance in the 1990s. Catherine, thanks so much for speaking with me today.
Thank you, Desiree.
This has been Desiree Helligers for the Old Mole Variety Hour.